Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. Most important thing in life will always be the
Movie Squad.
Salute me, familia.
Welcome to the Movie Squad podcast. My name is Tristan Fidler.
And my name is Simon Morado.
This is an official RTRFM podcast where we share our weekly edition of Movie Chat as heard on Breakfast with Taylor. Every Friday morning, 7:30 a.m. on RTRFM 92.1. We cover new cinema releases. We cover new streaming releases. We cover the gamut of cinema. I think we strive to do that in every episode, but the difference between what people can receive in cinema might not be as vast a chasm or as clear as the two films that we're looking at with this episode. And we start, maybe I think, from the top in terms of artistic achievement with the film that you take a look at, Simon.
Yeah, well, I take a brief look at All the Beauty and Bloodshed from director Laura Poitras, Oscar-nominated fare, a documentary about Nan Goldin and about the harrowing toll that drug addiction takes on Americans. And then what do you look at after that, Tristan?
We look at a film that takes a different angle on the drug problem in America and the world, which is the film Cocaine Bear, directed by Elizabeth Banks, inspired very loosely on a true story and basically coming up with a very kind of horror comedy view of a bear that is turned even more ferocious by its addiction to cocaine.
And then we take another, and I feel like we do that. Yeah, like you say, we try and do this every week, but it is real whiplash for the audience of Movie Squad, of which they're a legion. But then we do take a look at After Sun, a highly anticipated here in Australia drama, Oscar-nominated drama, starring Paul Mescal and directed by Charlotte Wells. And after the review of After Sun, which both you and I have seen, I will share my interview with Charlotte. We spoke a couple of weeks ago and talked a lot about the film, the semi-autobiographical nature of it, even the transition that I flag in the review as making me gasp. We talk about that as well. So a bit of a jam-packed episode, but one that people will need their neck braces for.
Yes, and we start by checking in on the Perth Festival and taking a look at All the Beauty and the Bloodshed.
Photography is like a flash of euphoria and gave me a voice. Once I started sharing the work, it was really heavy resistance, especially from male artists and gallerists who said, this isn't photography. Nobody photographs their own life. Dance,
dance, dance. The photographer, Nan Goldin. She's a major name in the art world.
The work was incredibly political. It was about power, and particularly about the power that men have over women and how that power is translated up in society.
100,000 dead! 100,000 dead!
Well, it is 7:30 on a Friday, and it is the place that you know to be at this time. It is Movie Squad, and joining you each and every week to unpack what is happening in cinema. Tristan, good morning.
Good morning.
Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
Doing very well. It's another big week. There's some very interesting films we'll touch on this week. But before we do, Simon, the Lottery West film season is so close to wrapping up. There's still a couple of films and a couple of weeks left, including next week's film, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. Do you want to quickly let us know what this one's about?
Absolutely, because as they say, it's later than you think. The Perth Fest season is almost over, but there are some great films still coming up. And All the Beauty and the Bloodshed is one that if you haven't seen anything in the season thus far, it probably is one that you would want to make the time to go and see. It is nominated for Best Documentary at the coming Oscars and comes from director Laura Poitras, who made Citizen 4, the very good film about Edward Snowden. She also made Risk, the very bad film about Julian Assange. But as a journalist and a filmmaker, obviously, is really interesting. And this is probably, in my opinion, her best film. Looks at the life of Nan Goldin, a very iconic artist and photographer who shares with Poitras and us through her photos and narration, the story, somewhat tragic story, of her upbringing and ultimately her drug addiction, her addiction to OxyContin, and really focuses and hones in on her sort of latter-day mission, which is to protest the Sackler family, who people will probably know from the news or the TV show Dope Sick, as being the developers of OxyContin. And what Nan Golden does, along with PAIN, the group, and it stands for Prescription Addiction Intervention Now, is they go and protest at art galleries and art organizations, and they do such things as die-ins, where they'll literally lay on the floor and obstruct people entering. And basically, organizations that have taken money from the Sackler family to, you know, with the Sackler family, you know, washing their quote-unquote dirty money through these respectable and artistic organizations who would very much like the money. And I think there's such an interesting parallel to what's going on, not just in WA, but the world today and the protests we're seeing. So really interesting film. Tristan, I don't know how you feel about Laura Poitras as a filmmaker. Citizen 4, sort of a spy movie in a sense.
Well, I haven't actually seen those other two films, but I've heard a lot of good things about this, and I know a little bit about Nan Golden, but it sounds like a very interesting documentary in that it's not just like looking at an artist's career. It's kind of like focused on the here and now and what they're doing with basically their success, their privilege, and in order to, kind of make an impact in what seems to be like a real issue and a real problem, not just in America, but other places as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You get that kind of, I hate to say it, but that bite-sized, accessible package of here is Nan Golden and why she's important. But then there's this really interesting story about how an artist is using their not necessarily their skill set, but, you know, these arenas that they've been fated in, how they're now turning against them to make a wider societal point. And yeah, really powerful movie. Taylor, I don't know if this is on your list to see.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think I'm going to have to wait for this one. I'm not necessarily a fan of an outdoor cinema like you are, Simon, either. but this is a super interesting story and not one that I know much about. And I think a few people out there will be on the same page as me. It's in season, though, as part of the Lottery West film season at Perth Festival. Opens on Monday and runs through for 7 days there. All right, we're going to get stuck into our very first film today.
What
Tristan.
Was that?
Well, you know, that's just an extra.
Oh, that's a little,
that's
yeah,
a little extra one.
Bush, yeah.
Yes, it's a taster of what's to come because really this is the main course.
Right.
Tristan, take us through Cocaine Bear.
Medic!
Beth, we should go.
Millions of dollars worth of cocaine fell from the sky this morning in Knoxville, Tennessee.
There's more of this
out there.
They dumped it somewhere.
I'm looking for my daughter.
Forest is a dangerous place.
Hey, Henry, check it out. Something got into it.
A deer, maybe.
A lot of cocaine was lost.
I need you to go and get it.
No, don't eat that, don't eat that.
Let's see what kind of effect that has on me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are movies and real movies like Cocaine Bear. And what a
this
title.
This is cinema.
Yes, yes. And it's out in cinemas this week, and it's inspired by a true story. Now, are either of you familiar with this true story that this film is based on?
No. I beg to differ about the legitimacy of the entirety of Cocaine Bear.
Well, I'm only familiar with the true story from when they announced they were making a movie called Cocaine Bear that was based on real events. So I was aware of it, you know, from a few years ago, but I don't really have any details in my mind about what occurred.
Well, it's kind of more of a starting point, really. In 1985, in Georgia, USA, a drug smuggler named Andrew Thornton parachuted out of a small light aircraft and didn't make it. Was found with weapons, with drugs, and with money. And then across the Chattahoochee National Forest, packages of cocaine were found that he had thrown out of the plane, I mean, as part of his drug smuggling operation. And found amongst the packages of cocaine was a black bear who died from ingesting 3 to 4 grams of cocaine. So that's, you know, that's very interesting. That's very kind of bizarre. But I guess that's a starting point for a movie. But Cocaine Bear, this new movie, really twists the truth a bit there, because it envisions that that the bear ingesting cocaine gives it a kind of more ferocity, almost like super animal abilities in terms of its addiction and thirst for cocaine. So kind of, yeah, bending the truth a little bit there. But it comes from producers Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who people might be familiar from. They directed the Lego Movie, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and the 21 Jump Street movies. And this is directed by actor Elizabeth Banks, who is following up other directorial efforts like Pitch Perfect 2 and the Charlie's Angel reboot, which didn't do so well, even though it had a really great Kirsten Stewart performance. So this movie is set in 1985 in the Chattahoochee Forest. We follow a couple of characters, including some low-level hoods, Alden Ehrlich from Solo, O'Shea Jackson from Straight Outta Compton. They're there to recover the drugs for a gangster played by Ray Liotta in one of his last roles. The film is dedicated to his memory. And then there's also a police detective, Isaiah Whitlock Jr. from The Wire, who's also trying to look for the drugs, a park ranger played by Margot Martindale, and a woman who, Kerry Russell from Felicity and the Americans. And the main things we know about her is that she's a mother and a nurse, and she's looking for a daughter, Brooklyn Prince, and friend Christian Coveney, who've gone out hiking, and out there in the forest is this cocaine crazy bear who, leading to mayhem, laughter, and lots of violence. So that's the movie Cocaine Bear. And I went to a screening. The audience were enjoying it. There were a lot of laughs. And there's a fair bit of grisly violence that I would say borders maybe on the mean and nasty side of things. This film I did not like. There were scenes with the characters, and particularly scenes not involving the bear, where characters were kind of talking. And I kept thinking, did the filmmakers ever ask themselves, why did this scene need to exist? Like, there's a scene where Alden Ehrlich and O'Shea Jackson Jr. are walking around the forest playing 20 Questions. And to me, I compared it to, you know, like, the Charlie Brown Peanuts cartoons with the adults talk and they just go mwah, 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 mwah. That's what it felt like to me. There was no like humor, there was no interest. The film didn't really work for me in that I didn't really care about any of the characters, whether they lived or die, so there's no stakes or suspense. And then I didn't think it was that funny, and I just think it didn't really hit the mark in terms of bringing together the ultra-violence that it commits in a lot of sequences and the laughs that it's going for. But a lot of the people in the audience did enjoy it, and there have been some good, you know, reactions or reviews, but it's definitely one of those situations where I'm walking out going, did I see the same film? But look, so I didn't think much of Cocaine Bear, and I don't know if it's going to survive past this month's notoriety and will be up there with Snakes on a Plane in terms of title / concept. Now, Simon, you haven't seen this film. When you heard about this project being announced, did it like intrigue you? Were you interested in this film?
Well, what intrigues me more is when Tristan says about characters, I don't care whether they live or die. Because that to me just really speaks to who, you know, the Tristan that I know.
Yes.
Look, I'm intrigued. You know, the cocaine bear of it all is fun. Like, sure. as a concept, or whether it's a, you know, like, it's a bear attack movie, but the bear is on cocaine.
Yes,
as a tagline, I'm interested in that. More interesting to me is that the cast is really good. And, like, Kerry Russell is great. Mm. Brooklyn Prince, who people may know from the Florida Project, was so good in that. And I'm kind of keen to see, like, what she does outside of those. I mean, I assume she's still, you know, only 10 or 11 or 12, but you know how her career develops and what kind of actor she is. And O'Shea Jackson Jr. is really charismatic, and Ray Liotta, of course. So Margot Martindale now in an action film, I'm always down for that combination. But there is that little element of it where I feel like, all right, at the end of the day, is it more than the title? And you're suggesting it's not. Elizabeth Banks as a director does not film me with a lot of confidence, despite, you know, she's a excellent and very funny and charismatic actor. I don't know that I've seen a film of hers that has a autorial stamp or some kind of flair where I go, what's she bringing to this? But also, maybe she just wants to be a journeywoman director and was drawn to the script of Cocaine Bear. So these are the things that are tempering my anticipation, whereas I think the average punter is just seeing the title and going, hell yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mm. Taylor, all the Beauty and the Bloodshed, you've tabled. You've tabled that one. But Cocaine Bear, have you pre-ordered your tickets?
Oh, this one doesn't even make it into the room, let alone onto the table. I go back and forth on Elizabeth Banks. I think she's a great actor. I think that Pitch Perfect and Cocaine Bear as well, just super gimmicky and definitely not what I'm into. I'm excited for Cocaine Esky shot off the coast of Albany before I'm excited for Cocaine Bear shot in the Georgian woods.
Yeah, look, it's just definitely as Simon was saying, like, I don't think there's much beyond the concept of the idea of like, well, a bear in real life took cocaine. What if we made this kind of movie around it? But it doesn't even get to the level of like a Jaws knockoff. Like, the film that I kept thinking about was the Piranha remake, Piranha 3D, in that I thought that was a better version of a big budget studio release that tries to be like an exploitation horror comedy. And that, you know, like goes for the lowest common denominator, but I remember having a good time watching this one. Whereas this one, yeah, you spend a lot of time with characters that just don't, they're not funny, or that you don't really kind of have anything. And I was just hoping for that they pushed it even further. Like, why not have a picnic festival happened, and the mayor is like, we've got to get this picnic festival happening, and the cocaine bear is terrorizing them.
That's
like, you know,
really funny.
Yeah, yeah. Like, go for that. But it just sticks to the idea of the characters going, oh my God, that bear did cocaine. It's a cocaine bear. And that's like the level of humor, basically, of this whole movie.
I feel like the question of what if a bear took cocaine doesn't need to be answered. And like, realistically, it was answered, yes. And it died.
Yes.
It's kind of the end of the story.
I read an interview where, like, Elizabeth Banks was kind of saying, oh, this is the movie's, like, the movie is like the bear's revenge. But
the
I was
bear's
like,
redemption story, she said, which I was like, for what?
Yeah, I thought that was a bit of a long bow to draw to try to make it have some thematic weight. But it's out in cinemas now. If you have a good time, you know, I'm happy for you, but yeah, I didn't think it was good.
Tristan, how does it compare to David Mamet's The Edge?
Oh, well, I mean, I was thinking about that. That was back in the days of bear actors like Bart the Bear. And no, this is definitely something that's created through CGI and performers. I mean, it's pretty well done, but it is another one of these films that takes place, the climax takes place at night. And so you can't really see much of anything because they need that for the CGI. So yeah, I wish the climax was a little bit more lighter that I could see what was going on. Yeah.
All right, Cocaine Bear is in cinemas this week. You've heard our feelings about it. We'd love to hear yours. 0405 921 921. It's Movie Squad. Tristan and Simon are here, and unsurprisingly, folks, nobody has weighed in about Cocaine Bear this week. We're going to change pace now drastically, Simon. Tell us all about After Sun.
Yeah, I'm still trying to level myself, to be honest with you. There's a vibe shift coming, and we kept talking about Cocaine Bear through the break. Mm-hmm. So let's turn our attention now to After Sun.
I love you.
Love you.
Why don't you go over and introduce yourself?
Dad, no, they're like kids. Why don't you go over and introduce yourself?
Sophie, they're like old.
A film we've been waiting a little while for here in Australia. Tristan, you and I even received an email from a listener at the end of 2022 saying that After Sun was their favourite film of last year. And we were aware of it, but hadn't had the chance to see it yet. But it's now in cinemas off the heels of the slew of awards it's been receiving and nominated for. Director and writer Charlotte Wells, who I was able to interview, and that aired on Tuesday on Brekkie with Taylor. She has won a BAFTA. She's won a Directors Guild of America award, all for being a first-time feature filmmaker. And star Paul Mescal has been nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars, one of the more pleasing surprises to come out of this very small film's rapturous reception and kind of avalanche of critical support. But I do want to know, before we get into the meat of the film, Taylor, Tristan, have either of you seen Normal People? That was Paul Mescal's sort of breakout TV role, or are you familiar with him outside of the acclaim he's been getting for After Sun?
Oh, yes. I mean, I read the book Normal People, and so was anticipating the show. And enjoyed the show mainly on the basis of the performances, and it definitely feels like Paul Mescal is having a moment and, you know, is on the, I think, on the rise. And it seems interesting in that I think even though it's been announced that he's going to be in Gladiator 2 or something like that, that he has a preference for doing films like After Sun. So I'm interested to see where he goes because I think he's quite good. Taylor?
I have not seen Normal People, but I listened to a podcast that I listen to quite regularly, and the recent guest was Paul Mescal, and was enough to get me over the line because he's so charming and so lovely. And I'm looking forward to, like, yeah, watching him pop up in more stuff.
Absolutely. And the only thing I haven't seen Normal People. The only thing I'd seen him in was The Lost Daughter, the Maggie Gyllenhaal directed film from a couple of years ago. Very small performance in that. So I was kind of happy to go into this somewhat unaware of his, I guess, character or persona or just his swath of talents that I'm sure a majority of people will be introduced to in After Sun. But in this movie, he plays Callum, a man about to turn 31 on a Turkish holiday with his daughter, Sophie, played by Frankie Corio. She's a preteen. It's set in the late 1990s, and it's a fairly unassuming, uneventful few days that we spend with them in this Turkish beachside resort. It's clearly a discount or budget holiday. He's having some money troubles. He's recently broken up with his long-term partner, not Sophie's mum, although he does have a good relationship with Sophie's mum. And we just spy a few moments of despair, maybe a little bit of anxiety from Callum. And he seems to not be very good at taking care of himself. He's going through something. He starts the movie with an injury, and we find a few more on him as the film progresses. Now, that's all very understated, unassuming, like I said, but there's a very subtle framing device to the film, and in fact, the very first moment of the movie is the adult Sophie, played by Celia Rylson-Hall in an almost wordless performance, watching a home movie from this holiday. We see her playing the tape, rewinding the tape of her as a child having a conversation with Callum in Turkey. And she's looking for something. There's a mystery here. There's a mystery to her dad that she's trying to solve. In the present day, she's about to turn 31 as well. She has a child. But there's something that she has realized that was formative about this trip. And After Sun ultimately becomes about Sophie and us, the viewer, watching this very low-key holiday trying to solve the mystery of Callum. And it is a movie about the unknowability of other people and what it means to love someone that you will just never, ever be able to access the inner thoughts and motivations of. I'm dancing around a lot here because this isn't Glass Onion. This is not a mystery, like a whodunit style movie, but it is a movie mystery of the soul and of the people you care about. And it's an incredibly powerful film that I've now watched twice because I think it is rewarded by rewatchings. And it's a film that I want to preface by saying not quote unquote a lot happens in terms of actual narrative activity. But there is a world of action going on under the surface here, and I thought it is just an incredibly beautiful picture. Tristan, how did you feel about After Sun?
I really liked it. I thought the performances, particularly from Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio, are really good. And yeah, it gets across that kind of just the awkwardness of being at that age, but, you know, of also just being with family and the kind of the moments where you are at loggerheads and then also, like, are really close. I don't know if it really had the impact that I was hoping for, and I don't know whether that's due to the hype that's around it. I had heard a lot about The Last Shot, and I thought it was good, but I was expecting maybe just from all the chatter. So, and I think that some people who were at the screening that I went to maybe were a bit surprised at how plotless it is. Like, you really are just, like, hanging with these two characters, and not everything is really explained or given, which I really appreciated. And the only other thing is that I thought there was going to be more done with the video, and then sometimes with a character who is at one age and another, I think it's good that they're played by two different actors, but I either wanted more of that person, the adult in the frame, as it were, or maybe a different person cast in it. But overall, I really liked it, and I think the performances are particularly fantastic.
How much of this film focuses on that father-daughter relationship, Simon?
99.9% of it. Cool. It is pretty much these two characters. There are other people that they meet and encounter along the trip, and it is a bit about, you know, Sophie's, I guess, coming to terms with her, you know, she's a pubescent child, you know, and discovering older kids and seeing, you know, there are lots of moments of her watching these older kids have more risque conversations or making out with one another. And it's interesting how that informs what we know about the adult Sophie and her relationship. But ultimately, it's about these two characters, you know, the fun, the goofy fun they have together, but also some of the little stouches they have. And what we ultimately discover, or maybe infer, because it is a movie that does play with a lot of subtlety here, that this is a really, really meaningful trip where not a lot happens. And that is kind of the key to the mystery and what Sophie, adult Sophie, is wrestling with. Like, she's looking for answers at an event where there just aren't many to be found. I personally found that really, really itself powerful and heartbreaking. And Tristan, I say to the audience in your screening of After Sun, Cocaine Bears in Cinema 3, you know? So this is a movie, I'm being facetious, this is a movie where, you know, you've got to go in knowing, like, all right, I'm going to have to be patient here. I'm not going to get all the answers. I'm going to have to meet this movie halfway. But I think if you do, you'll really be rewarded. And I think even cinematically, formally, it's a breathtaking film. I asked Charlotte about this, and there's a transition in the movie that made me gasp. Like, it's literally a pan from, you know, paragliders in the sky, and then suddenly there's a reflection in the pool. And there's great music in it. It's set in the late 1990s, like I said. So Catatonia's Road Rage, Blur's Tender, Tub Thumping gets a play. But there's also a recurring motif that I won't mention that's a bit more fantastical, a bit more abstract. And the climax of the movie is set to Queen and David Bowie's Under Pressure. But it's an incredible highlight. So After Sun, again, it ain't Cocaine Bear. But if you go in knowing that and getting ready to embrace the mystery, I think you will be so rewarded.
Oh, I love this. It's After Sun. If you want to listen back to Simon's conversation with the writer-director Charlotte Wells as well, that's available on the website right now. This might be one for you this weekend, folks. This weekend, I'm going to see Magic Mike. It's happening.
You're doing it. Magic Mike's Last Dance,
Of course. Yeah, not to be confused with the other in the Magic Mike canon.
Well, are you pre-gaming with Magic Mike, then Magic Mike XXL?
Absolutely not. That is Movie Squad for this week. Thank you to Patton Fremantle, who says, Taylor, we're still on Cocaine Bear, and I feel like we will be for weeks. Taylor, I look forward to the WA spin-off of Cocaine Bear. Working title is Crystal Meth Quokka. Apparently it's terrifying. Pat, I'll say to you what I said to Simon and Tristan. Not all stories need to be told. Folks, thank you very much. We'll catch up again next Friday.
Speak then.
Think you'll ever move back to Scotland?
No.
Why?
There's this feeling, once you leave where you're from, that you don't totally belong there again. You okay through there?
Don't you ever feel like tired and down and feels like your bones don't work, like you're sinking?
We're here to have a good time, eh?
First of all, I do want to start by congratulating you and indirectly Paul on his Best Actor nomination. Even though he's playing a young dad, yeah, even though he's playing a young dad here, he is still nonetheless younger than the character, Callum. He's only in his mid-20s. I guess, what gave you the confidence that he could carry the weight of that role?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think what became clear to me and to my casting director over the course of considering Callum specifically is that, just like Sophie, he was on the precipice between one stage of life and another. And while he's 30, turning 31 in the film, he is mistaken for somebody much younger. And it really presented a casting challenge for somebody who was exactly that. And in the end, the solution, it turned out, was just to cast somebody who was a little bit younger, but who had a feeling of a certain type of maturity, I suppose, because I think there is a big difference between 25, which Paul was at the time that we shot, and 30, turning 31. I think that's a significant development in life and experience. But Paul, he had it. I didn't really worry about it from the moment that we met. He spoke so thoughtfully about the character. He didn't seem worried about it. He's such a tremendous actor. And he just had this warmth and openness and capacity for vulnerability that felt really important to the role, and also physicality that felt important to the role. He feels very stable. And I think that was essential so that we, as filmmakers, maintained control over the gradual revealing of Callum's private struggle over the course of the film.
Now, you've said this movie is unmistakably fiction, but very personal. Now, I'm not going to press you on how autobiographical it might have been, though I do know you've shared photos of yourself aged 11 and your own dad, aged 31, in Turkey. So when casting Frankie as young Sophie, what were you looking for? Was it really down to someone that had that chemistry with Paul? Or were you, you know, maybe subconsciously, I don't know, looking for someone, a young actor, that felt like a young you?
Well, I can't speak for my subconscious, much though I wish I could at times, to be honest with you. It's always cropping up and getting in the way. I mean, we started with casting Sophie. We knew it would take a long time. It took us about 6 months. We had submissions from around 800 kids. And I don't know. It is really hard to say to what degree I was pulled towards someone who reminded me of myself. Certainly consciously, that wasn't what I was looking for. I was looking, first and foremost, we were looking for someone who could do it. You know, it's a lot that you're asking of somebody who's never really performed before to essentially hold together a feature film that really was resting on her shoulders in so many ways. I was looking for someone who felt authentically a kid, who didn't feel overly precocious or like an adult in a kid's body. I wanted Sophie to be goofy like a kid, a bit annoying like a kid, really charming and observant like a kid. I'd say that was the primary thing that I was looking for. And we found all of that and so much more in Frankie.
Absolutely. And Frankie's so good in this film. And yeah, not precocious at all. Very, hard on her sleeve. And there's that moment where she's singing karaoke. She's singing Losing My Religion. And, you know, she's doing the kid thing of trying to get her dad down. And then obviously her heart kind of sinks. Very kid-like. I do have to ask, have you ever sung Losing My Religion at karaoke when you were a kid? Is that autobiographical? Can we go there?
That is not autobiographical. I did, on a holiday with my mom and my aunt, sing a rendition of Bon Jovi's Always at karaoke, and will never forget the look on my mom's face when I came back up to the hotel room of just absolute horror and embarrassment on my behalf. I'd say that was the moment that inspired the karaoke scene in the film. And that is the way in which I say the film is personal, but not autobiographical. That is the type of detail that I'm drawing from, scattered from through many different experiences throughout childhood. But the horrors of karaoke, live on in me today.
Well, you managed to avoid Always on the soundtrack, but the needle drops in the movie are fantastic. I mean, you've repurposed Chumbawamba's Tub Thumping for good rather than evil. And Macarena's in there. But maybe one of my favourite shots in the film, maybe the best transition of the past year, is set to Road Rage by Catatonia, where the camera drifts from the sky to a reflection of the pool, which sort of echoes the opening shot, which is very much about someone reflecting on the past. These particular songs, Blur's Tender is also in there very prominently. What do they trigger for you? Like, what role does music play in your memories?
You've got me standing out of my seat at your mention of that transition from Road Rage, because I really fought for that transition.
Let's go to that. What did you have to fight for in that moment?
Well, so it's interesting. Road Rage was used there. I mean, it's a song I adore. I really love that song. And the soundtrack is a mix of stuff that I really liked, that I had a relationship to, but nothing too intimate, because otherwise really made it hard to focus on cutting and evaluating performance if there was a song I knew too well. There are exceptions. Tender is certainly a song that I know inside out. But Road Rage was just one of those songs I'd always loved. And we had it in the background of a scene in which she's playing on the motorbikes with Michael, the boy just a little bit older than her. And And it was an accident. It was extended on the timeline. And it was extended on the timeline at just a really fortuitous place where we cut and there's this pan of the vista from their hotel room and the song changes and suddenly the lyrics feel so relevant to the scene at hand and the tone changes and it just creates such a feeling. And Blair cut this really lovely sequence, like you say, of the paragliders. And it is just a moment that, like, I remember at some point getting feedback on and the feedback kind of trying to veer away from music over the cut. And it just felt like such a happy accident to me. And just one of the most satisfying moments in the film where everything aligns. And I'm always interested in how picture and sound are working either with or against each other, and often against each other. But I think sometimes just letting everything line up and work in concert with each other is really satisfying. And that's certainly a moment where I think that occurs in the film.
No, absolutely. I feel like I can say with confidence here, that person was wrong, Charlotte, whoever was advising you. They were wrong on that front. That's a great moment. There's also a climactic rendition of Under Pressure. And I will admit, yep, when I heard the song kick in, and I love the song, I did think, okay, we're ending on this note. I've seen this film before. But then it does shift and mutate into something really moving, as the song, you know, is and once was. How did you land on that song, which is so ingrained, not in all of us, but in film, right? And turn it into this sort of ominous, dread-inducing version?
Yeah, it starts kind of at the end, because I still don't think that song is great for when they arrive back at the hotel. It's a really odd choice. And I can see why your mind would have gone in the direction that it did when you heard it. But the truth is that I started from where it ends. Like, I knew of this version where the vocals are pulled out a little bit more and you can really hear Freddie Mercury and David Bowie's voices just going at each other in that sense of like real desperation in Freddie Mercury's voice in a way, and the more romanticism of David Bowie's voice. And I laid it in, I brought it in, I think, because I felt something in listening to that track, and I wanted to be reminded of that as we worked through the rave. And just dropped it into the timeline and hit play, and it was just something very special. And then worked backward to bring it into the first part of the scene, and then worked with Oliver to do what I was just talking about, which is figure out how that scene evolves. And there really are these different sections to it, even though it feels like just one scene. There's moments where everything is working against each other and moments where it all aligns. And that moment where Oliver's cello meets Freddie Mercury's vocal slide is where everything just falls into place. And I think when listening to the film, that's certainly my favorite moment.
Well, I love that description. And I know that you've said, there's a beautiful note about the film you posted on the A24 website. And in it you say, you made this movie to relay a feeling you couldn't put into words. And what you're describing there, that's using the language of cinema to convey it. Again, I'm not going to ask you to put that feeling into words now. That's what the movie is for. But I did want to know, when in the act of making After Sun, whether it's writing it, shooting it, editing it, even now, did you feel like you had captured this intangible thing?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think anybody's put it in quite that way before, because I think in terms of exercising whatever it was I needed to exercise through working on this film, I'd say I arrived at most of that through writing the very first draft and all of the work that it took me to get to that point. That being said, I think when I first cut together the rave that night that I brought Under Pressure in, I did see something on screen visually that was exactly how I wanted it to feel. It's, you know, you don't execute perfectly always. Rarely do you execute perfectly. I'd say there's a handful of things in the film at most that I executed even close to perfectly, but I do think that scene is one of them. It's just how I wanted it to feel, and it's what I imagined when I wrote it on the page. And there is something immensely satisfying about that. And I think when you feel moved that late in the game, when you've been working on something for 6-7 years at this point, 7-8 years, whenever you feel moved by something, you pay attention, because otherwise you feel just clinically dead to most things. And it's just, it becomes very technical. And that's okay. It's okay to be technical most of the time because you rely back upon the point where it was emotion driving you in the script and that informed production. But I think when you do feel moved, you pay close attention. And that was true in that scene.
I think, you know, what's great about this film and how relatable it is, you know, even though it feels like a very specific experience and specific story that between Callum and Sophie, I think we've all had that moment where we've reflected on something from our childhood and gone, oh, our parents were probably going through something there, right? Like they were going through adulthood. And as an adult, you kind of understand all those complicated feelings and the pressures that are on you, let alone what Callum is specifically going through. So what has it been like sharing the movie and receiving people's interpretations of it?
It's been fascinating. It's been fascinating to see people choose different paths through the film to arrive at not necessarily the same conclusion in terms of narrative context, but the same feeling for the most part. There have been some really out of left field, which I've always found to be true with the films that I make. But I think for the most part, people feel the sense of loss at the end of the film. And also, I hope, an enduring sense of love, too, that this was a relationship that was filled with love and that mattered. But everybody, I think, clocks exactly what's going on at different points in the film, perceives what's going on with Callum at different points in the film, understands the overarching perspective of adult Sophie at different points. And I think that's just informed by people's life experiences and relationships and relationship to loss and grief. It is a film in which there's space for that. And I know that. And I know that that's inherent in the films that I've made and in my approach and my aversion to a certain type of exposition, that you walk this line of subtlety that creates space for the audience. And that's okay, because ultimately I'm most interested in feeling at the end of the day.
You know, I want you to know that you can talk to me about anything as you get older, you know? Done it all and you can too.
Wish we could have stayed for longer.
Me too.
So there you go. It's always a pleasure for us to review a film and then to talk to one of the people who made it, particularly, the director of After Sun. That was a great interview, Simon. And one thing I did want to kind of touch on or talk about was the use of music in movies and how sometimes, you know, for me, a certain song might belong to a movie or a TV show. And you mentioned in the interview about the ubiquity of Under Pressure as a kind of song, just, you know, that is, I think, a shorthand for almost like emotional kind of experience. But, for me, I was interested in that choice because to me that song belongs to another film. Like, do you have a film in mind when it comes to that song?
You know, I don't, because I think of you'll probably say it and I'll be like, well, of course. But I think of it as a classic movie trailer song.
Yes.
I'd be like Salisbury Hill, you know, which is like,
yes.
There are certainly those songs that belong to a movie and it's like, you can't touch that anymore. And then songs like Under Pressure, which is just, again, I love that song. I loved it growing up, but it's been done. And thankfully, Charlotte Wells does something different with it in After Sun. But what's the one movie you're thinking of?
I think of the scene in Gross Point Blank where he holds his friend's baby, and that's heard in the background when he's at the reunion. But very small moment, but that's one that does creep in there. And, I mean, the thing is, and this is the shorthand that comes with using, like, a popular song, like, the emotional content is already there in that song. You lay that down in a scene and you can just like raise it up by an emotional caliber. But it's a very interesting and different use in After Sun as well. And just to tie it back to the other film that we looked at is that Cocaine Bear opens with a song that I was like, whoa, wait a minute. And it's Jane by Jefferson Airplane, which I look to as the theme music for the Wet Hot American Summer movies.
Oh, of course.
So when it started, I was like, is this like... I mean, you know...
Well, she's in. Elizabeth Banks is in Wet Hot American Summer.
So some have taken it as a little kind of like tongue-in-cheek, oh, you know, this is kind of taking place in the same comedic realm as... I would argue that it does not, but...
If only it had used Higher and Higher, the original song from Wet Hot American Summer.
But, you know, that's the thing. I sometimes think there's so much music in the world, and I know that it's an issue with kind of getting the rights and clearing the budget to use songs. But whenever a movie uses something that I've seen used very well in something else, I always think, oh, that's such a lazy move. Like whoever the soundtrack or the music supervisor was just was like, well, that's in the bank. We can always just, you know, pull out that one whenever we need it.
I think one of those, you know, it belongs in the pantheon opposite Salisbury Hill and Under Pressure. Under Pressure was used very well in the trailer for Adaptation, which has stuck with me for some reason. Is Bubba O'Reilly? I'm starting to realize that I think Cameron Crowe has ruined a lot of music, and maybe that's not fair because he's made very good films and used music very well. But I think almost you could probably look at his soundtracks as movies. Songs you just can't touch anymore.
Yes.
Rightly or wrongly, he has either helped to crystallize them in film, or he has ruined a couple of them for all of us. But I think, yeah, Bubba O'Reilly's right up there. There's something about that sort of big, open-hearted, kind of open-key kind of guitar rock that I just think we've done. We've dealt with it.
Well, the two I think about is, and it, sometimes it is just the trailers. Like, it was used in the marketing of Bug's Life, I think. Sorry, like, you know, out here in the fields, that was just, like, used in the the trailer. And then around the same time in the late 90s, it's used as a big set piece, Scorsese-esque sequence in the Spike Lee film Summer of Sam.
Oh, yes. Actually, but that's really good. Yes. That's really good, that
there
bit.
There you go. So, you know, you might have your own examples of a song that belongs to a movie and is egregiously used. Or, yeah, as you were suggesting, Simon, maybe there are some songs we just don't need to hear anymore. But it's great.
Hanging in the rafters.
Yes.
Like, thank you for your service. We're good now.
So there you go. Thank you for listening to this jam-packed episode. We look at three movies, and we also have a great interview in there. So we look forward to talking to you again in the next episode of the Movie Squad podcast.